listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 144 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show, and joining me for our roundtable edition is the one and only Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
I'm lonely without the bolt.
I know. I don't know if we can keep calling it a roundtable.
It's more of a, what do you call it?
It's a DIY musician love seat.
Chat. We're sitting in the chat now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a DIY musician chat. We'll see. We might bring someone else in on the show. We'll see. Find some new blood for us. But anyway, how are things going there?
Pretty good. I've got a gig tonight, so after I clock out of work, I'm gonna pack my stuff up and drive to the gig.
Where are you playing at?
It's a place called Blue in Portland, Maine. And it's kind of a smaller venue, but it's a really good listening room. And the people that run it are really great about creating like a super artist-friendly, respectful environment. It's definitely not like a place you'd go and chat with your friends at the bar, but
yeah,
it's ideal. I love it.
Your mic is scratching a lot.
Oh.
Did
it stop?
Yeah, it stopped.
Okay.
Cool. Well, that sounds like fun. I had an interesting little experience with some of our music from one of the Hello Morning records. For longtime podcast listeners, you'll know that's a band that I was in here in the Portland area. But anyway, we've had some music with a licensing company for a while, and they gave us news that they got us a placement in the TV show Once Upon a Time. It's on ABC on Sunday nights. It's one of Disney's big shows that they're pushing. It's using their fairy tale characters, and this season they're using the characters from Frozen. So I thought, oh, that could be really cool. But then the funny thing was, in the contract it said the song may not be audible. I'm like, well, what's the point of that?
Now, explain that in licensing terms.
The interesting thing is that, you know, I've seen some shows where, you know, from show to show, things can be very loud, depending on how the person who's mixing the show and the style and vibe of the show. They may have background music really loud. They may have it very quiet. And I've seen some shows where, you know, the music, you can tell music is there. It's so faint that it's hard to tell you wouldn't be able to tell an artist from one artist from another, even with some of the, you know, more popular tracks are spending more money to license. That's just the way the show might be. But with this particular show, the funny thing was is it's all like cinematic orchestrated music. There's nothing in this show out that uses bands. And I watched it from top to bottom. And then I went back and looked at the contract and said that we were in the second hour. And I listened to that again. I'm like, we're not in there at all. There's no music in there. So
is this a show that has scenes that take place modern day, like where you could be in the background in a bar scene or something?
Yeah, and that's why I went back and listened to it again. And there's no music. There's like a part where a car pulls up. I'm like, well, maybe it was in there. And nope. I mean, it is not in there. So the contract did say may not be audible. And, you know, I think it's fine that ABC has its artist, I don't know what kind of fund that would be, endowment fund.
Charitable
rewards. Charitable rewards. Hey, you've hung in there this long. We had some extra cash on this TV show. We're going to give you some money.
But you guys got the check and cash.
Well, we'll be getting paid. I mean, TV always pays after it airs. But that's the thing. It's like, if it wasn't audible, can we really say that it was licensed? Well, we can't say it was licensed for that show, but we can't say it was in that show. We got paid by them.
Has had music licensed by.
Yeah, but the thing to me is that when it comes down to it, as an artist, yes, I want to get paid, but I also want people to hear my music. So I don't want people to give me money just because I exist. I want to. Because they actually used it in a way that people are hearing it and going, who was that band? But it's funny because that show, I would never ever think to pitch them on using artist music, just having seen it. You may remember way back in the day of CD Baby, I was actually doing that, pitching tracks in our catalog for film and TV placement, and I would go through and shows that like this, I would never have approached them because I'm like, they clearly don't use artist music, so I'm just wasting my time. So
yeah, it's like you want your music to be in shows like whatever the current day version of One Tree Hill is, where the songs are super prominent, and then like at the commercial break, they say, "That was Hello Morning, check it out on iTunes," or whatever.
Yeah, so it was interesting. It kind of, you know, I know some people get upset when someone like MTV approaches them and says, "Hey, we're not going to pay you a licensing fee, but the music will be featured prominently. We replay the episodes a ton, and you'll make decent performance royalties on the back end." To me, you know, that points to why that, I think, can work, because in those situations, I know a lot of the artists have gained some nice exposure and made more money than we will make off of this once upon a time placement, in air quotes.
When they file their, you know, whatever it's called, the cue sheet or whatever, to ASCAP and BMI, are they going to include
That's what I was wondering. It's like, why would they include it? It's not Audible. And how could we get performance royalties for something that's not really being performed?
Maybe dogs can hear it.
Yeah. Maybe so. I didn't ask my dog. Maybe he was rocking out to it. But yeah, it was funny. And the particular song, I'm like, how would that work in that show? It's just weird. So that was my weird. That just happened this week. That was on the Once Upon a Time that aired this past Sunday. And so that was my weird experience for the week. So I don't know if anyone else has had that happen to them and can speak to the performance royalty issue, but you know, it would be nice to get some money. It would be nice to get money and to increase exposure. So
it'd be nice if you got paid a lot of money for every weird experience you ever had.
That's true. I think, you know, in the music business, I mean, they're all weird, most of them. Other than that, getting ready to release our new Christmas record this Tuesday, which we're really excited about. So.
Oh yeah, and you guys have been getting nice reviews.
Yeah,
I saw one of them.
We hired a radio promoter, and a couple stations have started committing to adding it when they switched to Christmas music, and so we'll see. The Pledge Music campaign went well, so hopefully some good things will happen. Doing a Christmas album, it's weird on a whole bunch of levels, but speaking of weird experiences, but you have a very definite deadline. If you don't have the music available like the week of Thanksgiving or before, you might as well wait for the next year. So that kind of adds some extra pressure to it, but it's also kind of this thing that you kind of doing all this recording and writing and building to the release of the album, but then you kind of have to wait for this window of seasonality to pop up in order for it to be relevant, and so that adds an extra layer of consideration to everything you do.
Yeah, I'm curious now, in terms of hiring a radio promoter, once your album's out, like, would you hire one again next year to kind of remind folks that it's worth adding to their playlists, or is it sort of just a dead deal after that and you hope it caught on the first time around?
You know, that's a question we kind of bounced back around between the band, and we're kind of discussing, because, you know, it was coming down to the wire whether or not we would have money to afford the promoter. And this is our second Christmas record, but this time we have an original song that's perfect for radio, that we thought would play very well. We're with the first Christmas record. We got quite a bit of radio play, but the songs weren't original. And so we thought there'd be more interest this time and bigger possibilities. And so we debated whether or not, you know, if we don't have money, can we pitch it to radio next year? My gut instinct is no. Radio traditionally works like, if it's not a new release, we're not interested. But with Christmas music, it's possible that if we just laid low with radio and they didn't even know we had it out, maybe. But
like, you could just fake them and pretend it was brand new next year?
Yeah, just not even mention it. But I don't know. It's weird because with, you know, with Christmas music, they pull out a lot of classic stuff, even stuff that might have been released the year before. But I don't know how you get into that classic labeling where something people want to pull out every year. So we'll see. So yeah, we felt pretty strongly about getting the promoter for this year, and we've worked with him before, and so it seems to get results, and you know, we'll see. So far, it's looking like we'll at least break even on this thing. Chalk that up for a win.
Tune in for the Christmas 2015 episode of the podcast, and we'll have
a
year later review.
Yeah, we'll see. So, well, cool. Lots of stuff happening around the industry. Lots of news, and as people head into the holiday season and all that. So, let's get into the headlines.
Music.
Well, after much anticipation, YouTube has just announced the launch of its subscription streaming service, YouTube Music Key. YouTube Music Key, available in the U.S. and 6 European countries, will let subscribers listen to ad-free music, including full albums in high audio quality, and watch music videos, even when offline, for $9.99 a month, though the introductory price is $7.99. And your music and art tracks videos could be available on YouTube Music Key soon. As a CD Baby artist, if you've enrolled in our sync licensing program, your albums and singles will be delivered to YouTube Music Key. We will also deliver to YouTube high-quality album art videos, or what YouTube is calling art tracks, which play audio while displaying an image of your album cover. These videos are available not only to Music Key subscribers, but also ad-supported content accessible for free on YouTube.com. Ad revenue from these videos will work the same as any other video on YouTube. Revenue for streaming activity through YouTube Music Key will be paid to you by CD Baby, and you'll be able to view details in the accounting section of your member account. So it finally landed after only it being a year late. It's here.
I had the blog post ready to go, the news announcement, for at least 6 months, and about every 3 weeks or so I'd check in, see if I could publish. Nope, not yet.
Yep.
Finally it arrived.
Well, Pandora has released a study that makes them look really good. A study performed earlier this year by Pandora found that its spins have a positive effect on music sales. For new music, the average positive effect was a 2.31% increase in sales of track equivalent albums, a metric that counts 10 tracks as one album. For catalog songs, the average positive effect on sales was found to be about 2.66% increase. These effects differed between majors and independent labels. For new music, the positive effects were 2.82% for majors and 0.62% for independents, although the latter was not statistically significant. For catalog, the positive effects were 2.36% for majors and 3.85% for independents. Chris Harrison, Vice President of Business Affairs, said the study offers an empirical measure on what had previously been believed only through anecdotes. Now, via this study, we have clear proof of the Pandora effect and its positive contribution to the music economy beyond just our royalty payments as the highest paying form of radio. So there you have it. Proof. There is a Pandora bump.
Do you want me to comment now?
Sure.
What's the baseline they're comparing that bump to? Like, just sales that aren't referred from Pandora?
That's a good question there. Yeah, I don't know. It's because you're saying like new music had a bump of sales. It must be referrals from Pandora, because when you're listening to stuff, you can click a link to buy something. That has to be how they're
tracking. Right.
So it was interesting that independent label catalog performed at almost 4% increase, but new independent music didn't see much of a bump. I don't know if there's anything in those numbers significant. It might be that independent music buying communities are already engaged enough that they go out and buy the music regardless. So it's not like the fact that it's on Pandora got it a bump. It's clear that
maybe what it is, I don't know if Pandora actually works this way, but what if it's the fact that after some time has passed, they know which independent tracks kind of have staying power.
Yeah.
The rest sort of cycle off the regular play catalog, and then the rest of them are the ones that are going to perform well anyways.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. We'll see. All right, our last item. There's been much discussion about Taylor Swift's new release. For starters, 1989, the title of her new album, became the first album released this year to sell 1 million copies. After 3 weeks, it hit 2 million, selling 312,000 copies this past week alone, more than enough for it to hold on to the number one spot on Billboard's album chart. Those numbers might serve to validate Taylor Swift's recent decision to pull her catalog from Spotify, which set the music industry on fire with all sorts of opinions on whether or not her decision was a good or bad move. Some see it as a pivotal moment for artists who are concerned that Spotify encourages the free usage of music by people who would have bought the album. Others saw it as not much more than a publicity stunt and that the streaming world is here and artists just need to embrace it. Regardless of opinions, the move seems to have worked for Taylor, and it will be interesting to see how other artists react. So I was down at SF Music Tech last week, and I was speaking on a panel, and before the panel started, we said that you were not allowed to talk about this during the course of our panel or ask questions about it, mainly because every panel somehow ended up revolving around the whole Spotify, Taylor Swift thing, and it's like, enough already, let's talk about something different. So...
Interesting.
But yeah, lots of people were naysayers about the strategy. Spotify was very defensive about it. And they
posted those numbers of sort of what her potential revenue was going to be. And then Taylor Swift's management or label came out and said, actually, no, they were going to be this. And they can't even agree on what numbers to compare.
Yeah, and there was some going back and forth saying the manager's numbers were faulty, but regardless, they seem to have made out pretty well. And
yeah, she's just fine.
Yeah, she's going to be okay. She's not going to have to move back in with her parents.
Did you see that Saturday Night Live skit about the medicine you can take if you suddenly realize that you like Taylor Swift?
I heard about it. I have not seen it.
I need to take it because that Shake It Off song is amazing.
Well, I'll have to check it out. Yeah, so lots of people talking about that. I'm always curious what independent artists think about this issue. Where I tend to fall is, you know, when you're unknown or have a smaller audience and you're trying to expand your listening base, it's smart to have your music everywhere where people are discovering music. And, you know, like if you play a show at a club and there's this somebody in the audience who's just, you know, never heard of you before, I'm like, ah, I like that band, I'm gonna go check it out. In my opinion, it's good to have the, you know, if they pull up Spotify, for them to be able to discover your music. In, you know, as an artist promoting myself, I always direct my fans to the places where I'm gonna benefit the most, like sending them to cdbaby.com for downloads and CDs where, you know, you're gonna make a ton more money than just sending them to iTunes. And I'm clearly gonna give people iTunes links as well. But I think, you know, it's a matter of where you guide those people that are more in the fold of diehard fans. You know, I'm going to send the diehard fans to the place where they can spend the most money or I can make the most money, where people that haven't heard of me before, I want them to, if they use Spotify and somehow read a review or hear a song on the radio, they can at least go and find us easily and start bringing them into the fold. So that's kind of where I stand.
She's kind of an artist that, she's one of those artists where you can't look at her tactic and then really apply it to like your own DIY life, because she's someone who has millions of diehard fans. Like, she doesn't have a whole lot of, maybe she has casual fans too, but she just has this enormous fan base. So,
did you just out yourself as a diehard fan of Taylor Swift?
No, that's why I said she has. I'm a diehard fan of one song. But still.
Yeah. But the thing that I thought was interesting is that, you know, she has the ability to drive demand, and, you know, limiting supply is a great way to get demand to a frenzy, you know. Some comments that I've read about it in discussions I've had with people, the one thing I can, you know, I can agree with is sometimes there seems to be arrogance on the side of the retailers if it's their right to have every artist's music. And it's just not, you know, they, just because they exist and Spotify is a valid and big platform for people to enjoy music doesn't mean it's their right to have all the catalogs, you know. And I think that's where some of the discussion rubs me the wrong way, where it's not, nobody's wanting to come to the table and work directly with the artist community and say, how can we make this work for you? It's, this is what it's going to be, take it or leave it. And that's how it tends to go. And so when I see someone like Taylor Swift stand up like this, I think, well, you know, maybe enough of big artists might freak Spotify out that they'll come to the table and include everybody in the discussion. That's all I have on that.
It would be nice.
So if you have any thoughts or comments on the news, the headlines, if you want to weigh in on the Spotify issue or the YouTube music key service or even Pandora's numbers or just anything in general, you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or call our listener line at 360-524-2209, and we want to hear what you think. So feel free to chime in. Well, that, I think, last story is probably a good segue into the discussion for today. We're going to be discussing a recent keynote address by Steve Albini. Chris, do you want to give us a little background on who Steve Albini is?
Sure. He kind of came out of the post-punk movement in the late 70s and early 80s, and he's the frontman for a band called Shellac, but he's probably more known as a record producer, although he prefers to be called a recording engineer. But he's produced thousands of records, and he's worked with bands like Nirvana and the Pixies and lots of folks. So he definitely has a, I don't know if there's such a thing as a large cult following, but he's definitely one of those sort of iconic rock and roll figures. And he also, maybe it's relevant to this discussion to say that he's been pretty curmudgeonly about the music industry for as long as he's been active in it. And he's famously compared the music industry to, quote, a trench about 4 feet wide and 5 feet deep, maybe 60 yards long, filled with runny, decaying shit. So that was 20 years ago, and he has now changed his tune, and he's very happy and optimistic with how things are going now.
Yeah, so if we'll put a link to his keynote address. It was for a music conference down in Australia, and it was sort of his state of the music industry and his basic, you know, what do you call it? Feeling towards what was going on is that he's both satisfied and optimistic. So he goes into great detail about the old school music industry. The video's about an hour long. It's worth watching. You can find the transcript. The Guardian posted the whole thing as a transcript, which might be a quicker experience if you read fast, or it might be harder to follow along. But the interesting thing is he kind of rehashed a lot of the details of the old school music industry and why it was so terrible. And it actually, you know, it's funny because I was listening to it and I go, yeah, I remember that. I remember that, you know, when we, some of the things that he talks about are some of the things that if you haven't been on a label, especially, you know, label deals now can be a little bit more flexible, especially on indie side. But back in that day, there was like all these things built into a contract that a lot were holdovers from the vinyl days. Like, you know, things like they would hold back 20% of your revenue against breakage. Well, breakage was a big issue when people were shipping vinyl. But when you're shipping CDs and it's like, you know, unless something really bad happens to a box of CDs, you're not going to have breakage. In fact, he had a funny quote about it. I wrote it down. Let me see if I can find it. He said... your artists were charged breakage at a rate that implied someone was attacking the inventory with an axe.
He's so good. The whole speech is filled with those little, like, humorous, grumpy turns.
Yeah. So I remember getting a royalty statement. We were fortunate enough to have a song. Small Town Poets had a song on a compilation album. It was called Wow 1999. Similar idea to what they have, you know, that you've seen probably now. It's called like Now 1999 or Now 2004, that features big mainstream artists. But anyway, we had we're fortunate enough to have a song on there, and it was a song that I helped co-write. That compilation album went platinum, and it was. Because it's a compilation album and it had like 30 tracks on it, you already get a reduced royalty rate for that kind of inclusion on an album. But then I remember being so excited because I was so dirt poor at that time that when I was going to get a royalty that actually might help me pay my bills, I get the statement and there's the top line revenue that it's basically like, your inclusion of this song on this album generated this amount of royalties. And then there was deduction after deduction after deduction, so much so that it was less than 50% that I actually got. It was so depressing.
It's like looking at a your end of night settlement from a club when they take out like $150 for tacos.
Yeah, it was something like that. So in this video, Steve Albini talks a lot about those kind of things. And, you know, he kind of frames it in a way that I hadn't even really thought about, where basically it's a corporate club where people are scratching each other's back and it benefits them to pay each other for favors.
His one of my favorite moments, he says, the record industry was a leaky system riddled with inefficiencies, but a lot of people made a living through it. Record store owners, buyers, employees, ad agencies, designers, club owners, label reps, A&R, producers, recording studios, publicists, lawyers, journalists, program directors, distributors, tour managers, booking agents, band managers, and all the ancillary services they required: banking, shipping, printing, photography, travel agencies, limos, spandex wardrobe, cocaine dealers, prostitutes. Because of this, great bulk of the industry needed to sustain itself. Every facet of the industry was tailored to this need. And then he basically says, all of that, every single cent that you could basically attribute to the promotion of a band got charged to the band. So no artist was really making money unless you became like wildly successful. And in the meantime, that system just, like you said, encouraged inefficiencies and encouraged wasteful spending on behalf of the artist.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then he says, he talks a lot about how in that old system that not a lot of thought was put into the fans or the artists themselves. He says, like, fans were expected to listen to songs on the radio and buy albums. Bands were expected to tour to promote those albums. So it wasn't the idea of the artist building relationships with fans was not really much of the equation. And you can definitely, looking back, it's like, yeah, even in my experience, I definitely saw that and that's partly why, you know, a band like Small Town Poets, we were having a lot of success because we were building relationships directly with fans, and our label sitting there scratching their head, not understanding why people were buying our record. And it's like, it's weird when you have an album that's selling really well. It was the fastest debut album on that label in their history, and they had many platinum selling artists, and but yet they were like sitting there scratching their heads, and I was like, that's because it wasn't based on all those. Our success wasn't based on all those things of like going out and paying radio programmers to play it. and they were playing it because they liked it, you know. It was just very interesting. So if you listen to Steve talk about it, he does paint a very bleak view of the old school music industry.
Oh yeah, before we move on to the present or future that he's talking about, one thing I really thought was kind of an interesting reminder that even predates when I was making music. But we said, like, in the 70s and 80s, most bands went their entire careers without ever really even recording a note. And then those that were lucky enough to get studio funding from labels never made a cent. So the kind of when people think about, oh, the glory days when you were making all this money from music, it was such a tiny slice of actual working musicians that, like, basically there were no glory days. So
yeah,
stop looking back.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that when listening to him describe it, it's kind of like doing this Pledge Music campaign, and I promise this will make sense where I'm going with this. To do this Pledge Music campaign, I went back and scoured the archives of all the photos and video I had of that time. And for a pre-iPhone, everyone's got a video camera and camera with them at all times era, I took a lot of photos and a lot of video of everything we were doing. And going back through that, you know, I shed a few tears of being nostalgic, and there were some good times and some amazing experiences. But when it comes down to it, what that system was just, it's not sustainable for the artist. Because unless you are one of those top, you know, people that just strike it big, you're always basically living album to album, even if it's successful, because you're still working with an industry that's still saying whether or not you have the right to exist in their eyes. It doesn't matter if you're selling a lot of records. It's like one dude's making a decision whether or not, you know, your album's going to sound good or sound terrible, or it's going to just get shelved altogether. And those, you know, seeing that's the churn that most artists experienced in that system. You know, as music fans, you tend to think, oh, everybody, you know, I've heard their music on the radio, they must be doing well. And there's a few artists that have done very well. We all know that. But a lot of people, they just, it's like they get thrown in that churn and their career just isn't sustainable that way without them either getting burnt out, going broke, or just, you know, needing to do something else with their life. So, yeah, there was a lot of that reminding. And those are some of the reasons why when I decided to move on from the band at that time that played a part in it. It felt like I had no control over anything in my life. And those fans that we had built that loved our music weren't going to have access to it because some guy in an office who didn't like us to begin with kind of got cold on pushing our album like that should be. And that's just a weird reality to be in.
Yeah, I wonder if people that are younger now that just are starting to make music, like, must just in a way take it for granted that connection to your fans is now direct instead of going through the label that had control basically over your kind of fan database as well as control over your actual recordings. And I wonder how much that's taken for granted now.
Well, and that's some of the things that Steve Albini points to. So let's get into the reasons why he's optimistic. And, you know, after listening to it, it's like, yeah, I, depending on when you talk to me, I'm usually very optimistic about music and music, the ability artists have to advance their career. You know, that's one of the things that I always have found exciting about music in this era. One of the reasons that I was drawn to come work at CD Baby is because if your music's out there and you're passionate about it, in this modern era, there's always this idea of you never know what can happen. Someone could find your music, something interesting, unique, cool, amazing can happen. And, you know, there's some things you need to do to make the chances of that happen increase, but still the fact that we're not living in a time of if your CD is not in a shelf at the local music store, You Have No Career, which was a very limited amount of people that even got that shelf space, and it was a limited window of time. You were allowed that shelf space if you were allowed the privilege to have it in the first place.
And even in the areas that we'll probably discuss where he is optimistic, it's not like he's promising success for everyone. He's still someone who came out of that hardcore music scene where it was like those guys kind of and women defined DIY for musicians.
Yeah.
And like, so I think what he's saying is if you're someone that already is going to work your ass off and put everything into this, like, this is the best time for you.
Yeah. Your mic is still scratching a lot. We need to tape it down.
I wonder if I hold it up.
Is that
better?
Yep, that's better.
Okay.
Excellent. That's some of his key points were that there's lots of music and it's easy to find. And that's probably one thing that artists that are brand new may take for granted. The fact that it is, there's lots of music, sure. A lot of people get frustrated with, like, how do you get through and break through the noise? But with simple, you know, Google searches, people can pretty much find anything that's out there and make a lot of cool connections. Where, you know, that was a frustration in the old school industry, that if you had like a 6 month window, if you weren't selling, your albums were going to be pulled and there was absolutely no way to get them ever. And, you know, he talks about how the band Death, who is actually using CD Baby to sell their music, resurrected their career because somebody put an old album that was not available. It might've been some unreleased material or something. I forget exactly what he said, but this fan community started growing around it again, and people were passing it around on the internet, and it resurrected their whole career, and they were able to go back and re-release music digitally, and now they're touring and playing music again because there's lots of music out there, but the internet has also made it much easier for fans and active online communities to gather around every niche and genre of music that exists.
Yeah, he compares it to a hall of fetishes. this kind of sexual scenario with where whatever your particular kink is, like, you can go into this hall and there it is, like 24/7. It's like, that's what the modern music distribution world is like. Anything you want.
Yeah,
and you can find the people online that will recommend new stuff in that niche too. So
yeah, and another key point that he has why it's better is that clearly the direct access to fans and how that has been a big game changer and allowing for a lot more opportunity. And this is one, you know, that I think it's really easy to take for granted, you know, and just thinking about how we just did this successful Pledge Music campaign and thinking back how different might the trajectory of Small Town Poets been for the years that kind of led up to kind of just taking a hiatus had we had direct access to fans and been able to do things where, you know, our first album sold about 200,000 copies, our second about 100,000, and it's like coming out of that second album going into the third and the band just wasn't able to sustain itself, and you're thinking, how's that even possible?
Sell that many records.
Yeah.
Yeah,
where it's like, no, just give me 1,000 of those people that loved, or 2,000 or 3,000 that love that album, and we can sustain ourselves for a long time. And so that's been a huge game changer. And we've seen that over and over again online. It's just good to remind ourselves of how that has changed in the artist's favor in such a big way. The other thing he mentions is that the internet has made it much easier to do the day-to-day of being in a band. And I mean, this is huge. I mean, you know, on the way to work today, you know, I was, before work, I did an interview with a radio show for our release this week over Skype. I was talking to my publicist on the way into work and, just the idea of organizing the band and getting people where they need to go over the internet. I mean, that just, it would take two or three people to help us do this and still, you know, make, without even being able to have a solid income to pay those people that really represent us well. You there?
Yeah, sorry, you cut out for a second.
Huh. Weird. So anyway, the internet has just made it so easy to connect with folks, get stuff done, get files to the press for them to review it. It's just so much easier. And that's something that's easy to take for granted, but is a huge thing. You know, I think about all the stuff that we're able to pull off with the internet.
One of the interesting things I thought about his speech when he was talking about the ability to find really, you know, loyal niche audience and to have that direct relationship with them as album sales kind of give way to downloads and downloads give way to streaming and revenue from recorded music goes down sort of per engagement or whatever you'd call it. He's been able to charge a lot more or make a lot more from Shellac's live performances. And he was saying that basically they toured in Eastern Europe and they don't have any distribution there. So basically he knew going into it that anyone that shows up at these shows that knows our music has gotten it for free. And it was great. He was like, that's awesome. Like all these people came out, they paid a lot of money, you know, many times what they would have paid 20 years to see them. And then through that, they were able to just get a lot more opportunities for gigging and touring over there. And I think some of those people did then start to purchase the music legally once it was sort of officially distributed to those regions.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that's a good point with what you can do and kind of seeing what's happening in different regions and know what's going on and being able to react to those situations and that helps advance you as an artist. And which some of the things he said to me was a reminder of why, like, I try to get content on every show, everything that we do, to just try and be able to use it for who knows what purpose. But yeah.
Content being video or
video, or recording live shows, doing whatever, because you never know what usage it might have and how people might react to it. And, you know, especially, you know, he's talking about touring and being able to tour in places that, you know, doesn't have distribution, knows that people are coming out to see the live show. So they got the music for free somehow, but, you know, being able to record those live shows, you know, those fans are going to be enthusiastic, but, you know, they don't tour that much, that his Banks, he's very busy recording, but being able to sell those recordings to people in regions where they're not going to tour, but they're, you know, the buzz is being built off of these regions where they do tour. And so I just think there's some good things that you can do. And, you know, cause his stories were interesting because he has a full-time job as an engineer. And, so when he does play, he's trying to make every bit of it count.
Yeah. This goes back to the very beginning of his speech, but I found this statement interesting now that we're kind of getting towards the end of his argument. But he said that there's a tacit assumption that when people are complaining about the lost revenue between the current industry and how it used to be, that there's an assumption that that revenue needs to be made up by other means somehow. And I think what he's saying is, like, when you eliminate all that bloated, inefficient stuff in the middle and you consider the shrinking revenues, it's still more than enough to support the people that matter, the bands and the audience. So, you know,
yeah,
eliminate as much as you can of that stuff in the middle. And then there's more, even though your music may be generating less money, you're making way more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was I think that's why the way that he laid out at the beginning, like, really gets very specific about all the things that he would label as waste, were important, because it's like you realize what a mountain of money was going to places that have no benefit to the artist, or the artist was paying for and didn't realize in most cases. And you know, it is you know, as an artist, when you're signed to a label, and if you go into the office and you see all these employees and it's a cool office building, and you know, all those people are showing up because they get paid to do a job. They're not going to show up if they don't get paid, and you're paying for it. So it's like, yeah, great. Your label may have this amazing office and this great view and all these cool resources, but that's coming out of your pocket. And
and so is the $700 dinner with your radio promoter and the DJ in LA.
Yeah, so those things are the kind of things that when you realize that you cut all that out, that there was a lot of waste, and especially, yeah, people just need to listen to him because he goes into some great detail and some that I thought were funny because since I was living in Nashville at the time when probably at the height of the old industry, some of what he talks about, people selling promotion CDs to used CD stores, he talks about that as pretty funny and sad at the same time. But some of his optimistic things that he points out is why he's optimistic for the future. But he does talk about that we need to figure out how to make this digital distribution work for everyone. And in this case, when he's talking about distribution, he's not talking about like a service like CD Baby, how to make getting your music from point A to point B better for everyone. What he's really talking about is the digital environment. How do we make the digital world work better for everybody? And, you know, he references a lot that people tend to go, we need to fix it this way, or we need to fix that. And he's like, you know, points out the fact that who is this we? Who are we talking about? Who has a seat at the table? And he really points out that if listeners don't have a seat at the table, that then any solution is doomed. And I thought that was an interesting perspective.
Oh, yeah. And he gave a great example of what that might look like. But now it totally escapes me what it was. But he basically gives an example of kind of a company forcing a particular music listening quote solution and yeah, why it would fail. Do you remember what that was?
I can't at this moment, but I remember.
Yeah, check it out. It was interesting.
So yeah, he references that saying that a lot of people are at the table and they're not talking. They're not including everybody. So it's like with the collective we that when you usually read articles and they refer to, we need to figure this out, it's usually people in offices trying to figure out how to preserve their offices and their paychecks, and not how do we make a music environment that flourishes all across the board. How do we make something that listeners will just absolutely love music so much and experience it? Maybe they'll just turn off their TVs altogether and just be music's all they want to dive into. Those kind of things where it's like, how do we engage listeners in a way? And also getting the artists and labels at the table where everybody is talking together and working on something that's mutually beneficial. And he points out, and I would agree with him 100%, that what bands want is a chance of exposing their music and getting paid by their audience. And he kind of goes into detail here, which I think he has some good examples about. He doesn't say getting paid for their music, but he says getting paid by their audience. And I think that's more of a proper perspective. Bands want to expose their music. And just like we were talking about, you know, getting paid by Once Upon a Time, but our music wasn't really in the show, so what does it matter? You know, thanks for the bit of cash, but it didn't really help expose our music to anybody. But the idea of getting paid by their audience may look different, and there's lots of opportunities. And I think that in some cases, we're still just kind of at the tip of the iceberg on that.
Yeah. And him earning more money than they used to, touring was one of those examples where, you know, it's not coming from recorded music sales or anything, but they're still getting paid by their audience. So.
Yeah, and you know, so a lot of people will say, well, I'm not touring, my music isn't the kind of music where I'm going to go out and tour, or I can't tour. I don't think that he's one of those where it's like, oh, you can't tour, or if you want to get paid, you got to go tour. He talks about some some details there that I can't remember at the moment, of just about really kind of reorienting your outlook a bit about what it means to make money from your music. And when he defines it as being paid by their audience, he has several scenarios he talks through that were interesting. And probably the most controversial thing he says is that he talks a lot about the idea of release. We refer to music as we release an album. And he kind of references that typically in, you know, life, when we release something, it's once it's released, it's out of our control. And that's kind of like where we are in the state of music, that when we release something with the internet, we just got to assume it's out of our control. And that, and kind of the idea of leaving bands and the audiences to work out the relationships, that's where the sustainable career is going to come from. Those two things were probably the most controversial things, or at least the one where releasing it and it's out of your control and it's going to be free or
yeah,
well,
and implicit in that was releasing copyright.
Yes.
To some extent, at least, like that was sort of a tag on at the end of his talk, but he's also saying we really need to re-examine what copyright means in the internet age.
Yeah. I thought he made some really good points there that are they're near the end of his talk. It's close to an hour long. I think it's worth hanging in there to hear. I would agree with a lot of what he says. I think if you don't hear what he says, it'd be easy to take our words out of context here and think that, well, if you think once you release music, it's out of your control, isn't that contradictory to what CD Baby does? I think if you hear what he's saying, you would understand that that's not what he's not saying, that, hey, if you release an album these days, just assume that no one should have to pay for it. That's not what he's saying at all. But what he's saying is you can't, with the internet, fighting against the fact that someone somewhere got it for free is kind of a futile type endeavor. And understanding that in the world of digital, there's going to be that element to everything. Did I lose you?
Nope. Oh. I was just trying to think of what I had to say on that subject.
So anyway, it's a good talk. I encourage people to check it out. I'd be curious to hear opinions of it, whether you think he's crazy, whether you think he's on target, or whether you think the viewpoint needs to be tweaked a little bit. I just, you know, a lot of artists were talking about it this week. It got passed around a lot online. I figured it was worth us discussing and addressing here and getting the artist community to talk about and see what people think. You know, he kind of sums up that there's more gigs, there's more songs available, bands are treated with more respect, there's more control. And it's kind of funny with that last thing we were talking about, as far as like when you release something, it kind of being out of your control almost, because the internet, there will be people that can access and do things with your music that you may not have control over. But in general, there's far more control the artist has over what happens with their music and what they can do with their music. Probably the better point, that there's more control over how you can take positive action, as opposed to, you know, someone in an office somewhere deciding that your music isn't good enough, so it's going to get shelved. He kind of ends it with saying that it's no longer possible to maintain control over digitized material, but the public good is not served by trying to, and exclusivity has come to an end. And so he kind of leaves on some a positive note, but something that's definitely controversial. So I'm curious to hear what artists think of that.
Steve Albini, happy.
He's
happy. Thought.
He's happy. You know, maybe 30 years of recording angry music.
he's sweated all of the anger from his soul. Now he's ready to be happy.
That's right. He's happy. So, yeah, interesting perspectives. It's the thing that's nice about his talk is that there's a lot of keynotes that get passed around, and I feel like a lot of them don't represent the artist viewpoint, or even somebody who can identify with the artist viewpoint, I should say. And he can, and he is an artist. And so I thought that's why this one was a little bit more unique and interesting to listen to. I go to a lot of music conferences and I hear a lot of people speak. And there's some folks where I'm like, yeah, I get what you're saying. You're good. You got a great business mind, but I don't think you understand what it's like to be an artist with the viewpoint you have. But I think with Steve, when you listen to his talk, you can tell he understands what it's like to be an artist. And that's why I find that his opinions seem to hold a little bit more weight when he's talking about this kind of stuff. And he's someone who's been in the industry for years and his livelihood depends on it. So check it out. We'll put a link to the video in the podcast show notes and you can comment there and weigh in. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can call the listener line at 360-524-2209. Let us know what you think. Are you optimistic? Are you satisfied? Are you doom and gloom? Are you frustrated? We want to know both. And if we get enough comments, maybe we'll have a whole nother roundtable discussion where we just let artists weigh in on that subject. So we'll be out next week. We won't have a new podcast. It'll probably be a couple weeks before we have a new one with Thanksgiving week. And also,
we should mention a particular shipping deal that's going on.
That's right. That's right. December 1st through 3rd. I should have put that in the news. We are 1 cent shipping at cdbaby.com. If you're selling CDs at CD Baby, we are making the price of shipping 1 cent. So you should tell your fans to load up on CDs. Doesn't affect your price or what you get paid. It's coming out of our pocket. We just want to help you sell more music.
And it's for domestic and international, as long as it's the standard mailing option.
Yeah,
and it's 1 cent whether your fans buy 1 or 100 of your discs.
Yep.
So
great deal. We'll be sending some more emails about that shortly, and take advantage of that. We're excited about that. I'm hoping artists sell a ton of music this holiday season. People get crazy excited over free shipping and. But this is 1 cent shipping, and it's off of your entire order, even international. So your entire order will be 1 cent. So that's cool. Take advantage of that, and it should help encourage your fans to load up on a couple extra copies to give out as gifts. And, so it'll probably be a couple weeks before we're back, because I'm going to, like I said at the top of the show, this new Small Town Poets Christmas album comes out on Tuesday the 25th. Feel free to buy a copy. but then I'm going to go out for a week's worth of shows. And, I figure I can get away with it at work, you know, going out and doing a week's worth of gigs because it's research and development.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
It's market research. That's what
market
it is.
Research, yeah.
So.
And then and I'll be in Oregon
in
a couple weeks. We can record one of these in person.
That's right. We can. So that'll be fun. So, all right, cool. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the podcast. We'll catch you next time.
Peace.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.